This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca, home of New York's craft cider. I love New York. Plan your getaway at visitithaca.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is William Carroll. We'll talk to William about working in iconic restaurants, wine, and more. We'll taste a Chenon from the Loire Valley for our weekly wine sip. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. St. Louis-born William Carroll spent a little time as a kid in Park City, Utah, and then headed east and continued to grow up in Irvington, New York. William literally went from busboy to Burgundy expert and everything in between. He did fine wine sales, studied at Le Cordon Bleu, and worked at restaurant Le Serre, he'll tell me later, in Paris, before heading back to New York for a lengthy stint at Dan Barber's Blue Hill at Stone Barns as ultimately beverage director. William recently left North Fork Table to become the beverage director and assistant GM at Danny Meyer's legendary Gramercy Tavern in New York City. Welcome to the Grape Nation, William.
Thank you so much.
Is all that accurate?
That is all accurate.
Okay, good. All right, we're talking to William live from the Heritage Radio Network studios in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We're in the back in two truck containers. It's good to be back here. This is about our fifth show, and it's good to be sitting across from William in person. William, let's talk about where you came from and where you are now. So give me a brief background on your life in wine and the biz and how you got to where you are, which right now is Gramercy Tavern.
Yeah, thank you. So originally, as you mentioned, from Park City, Utah, and then transplanted here to New York up in Westchester County. In terms of food and wine, there is no cute grandma in the kitchen story behind everything. I come from Hot Pockets and Mountain Dew and was lucky enough to really discover food, wine, and restaurants when I got to the end of high school. So first job was as a dishwasher and prep cook my senior year at a small restaurant in Irvington. About a year and a half later, I ended up being a busboy at a country club in Fairview, Connecticut. That's where I first got exposed to any type of fine wine.
And neither one of those discouraged you.
No, okay. I'm not sure why. I asked myself, why didn't you, you know, run away at first sight, but stuck with it and found wine in the process early on when I was 18. Again, had a very revelatory moment with wine at Fairview Country Club. Went on to continue school in New York City. Worked at a couple restaurants there. Ultimately landed at Restaurant Danielle when I was 19 as a busser and barback.
Wait, go back for a second.
Yes.
The country club.
The country club.
Was there a guy, you know, he was either the maitre d' or the head of the dining room or a wine guy? Was there a guy who knew a little about wine?
There was no guy.
There was no guy.
Was no
so
guy.
Where was that revelatory wine thing?
Yeah. So there was not really a serious wine program there or sommelier. Even the general manager, I don't think, was very wine savvy. Most of my job was filling buffets and dumping out slop buckets by the pool. But there was a lot of wine collector dinners held at the country club. So it wasn't on the staff side, but more the membership side, of course. A lot of very well-off members there.
Right.
And there was a
collectors
moment, collectors
too.
Big on Burgundy and classics and French. And there was one pivotal collector dinner towards the end of my only summer there, where a glass of 1971 French wine made its way back to the kitchen.
Was Bordeaux Burgundy?
So at the time, I only knew that it was French, it was white, and it was from 1971. I found out what the wine was 7 years later through a weird set of circumstances, but I did taste this thing, and it was the most amazing thing I'd ever tasted. The doors of perception exploded for me.
All right. So we need to check a few boxes.
Yeah.
So what year was that?
That would have been...
That you tasted that wine.
2010?
So let's say right around there, up or down, yeah. Whatever. Say 10. So you tasted a 71.
A sip of a 71 French white wine.
Okay, now you have to tell us, because you did find out what it was.
So I found out 7 years later, through, again, a weird set of circumstances at Simple Hill, that it was 1971 Chateau Riesec Sauternes.
Oh, it was a Sauternes.
Which makes a lot of sense for an 18-year-old's palate to be that blown away. Right. It, of course, it was sweet. It had acidity. It had botrytis and complexity.
Was it dark at that point? Don't those get, you know, darker?
Yeah, it was dark, kind of honeyed. This is me kind of filling in the gaps. When I was 18, it was like a sip of booze in the kitchen. So I didn't take too many tasting notes then. But again, it was, you know, a four-dimensional tasting experience in the first of my life.
All right, so I interrupted you. You left there. I think you said Danielle or something.
Correct.
Get me, you know, back to where we were.
Right. So re-enrolled in college at Hunter College on 68th Street. Found myself in the neighborhood of Restaurant Danielle. Ultimately, had the audacity to apply for a busboy position there, thinking I was hot stuff coming off of my, you know, country club days. And I was vetted and spent 9 months there. Along the way, or just prior to that, I met a French girl, a waitress at a restaurant who was from Paris. Long story short, she ended up getting deported from New York. And after doing so, or having happened, she basically invited me to move to Paris when I was 20.
Jesus.
So moved to Paris at 20.
You followed her.
Okay. No real plans. Just
wait. My bad. She was working at Danielle?
She was not. She was working at Match 65.
Okay.
Which is where I was just prior to Danielle.
She was in the business. Okay. Correct. So you hit it off. 20 years you follow old. Her back.
Correct.
Instant decision or a tough one to make?
I wouldn't say instant, but not the most difficult. I mean, 20 years old.
Were your parents like, what are you, out of your mind? You're not even 21? Or they were okay?
They had their doubts, but they ultimately believed in me. They saw the passion I already had for restaurants and said, you know, give it a go.
Okay, so that's locked in now, the restaurant passion thing.
Right, that was it.
So do you go to France like, okay, I'm into this hospitality thing. How do I do it? What do I do there? What's your thinking when you go there?
At that point, I knew I loved restaurants and service far more than I ever loved school or college. I had seen Restaurant Danielle, which was the first glimpse of a professional hospitality career. At the time, there was an amazing wine team of Jesse and Caleb and Raj at the helm and Edouard, you know, three-piece suits, working the floor.
Four superstars.
And they were really, for me, like, as a busboy, the Psalms were like the apex predators at Restaurant Danielle. So I went to France knowing that you could pursue hospitality seriously, that Michelin stars were a thing and sommelier was a career. So that was on my mind, but I had yet to really commit to that path.
Were these guys nice to you? Caleb and Edouard and, I mean, were you just the lowly busboy or did they pay decent attention to you?
Definitely decent attention. I mean, it is an old school French kitchen at the time doing 250, 300 covers a night.
But
so.
Danielle's sort of a good guy, so that trickles around.
A great guy, yeah. And everybody that worked there definitely invested in younger employees and busboys. There was, of course, a lot of tough love and extremely high standards working there. But at the end of the day, I have memories of polishing glassware and asking Raj what tannins were or what the word austere meant. And, you know,
he spent the time to answer.
He said, if you polish all those burgundies, I'll tell you what tannins
are. He was on a couple of weeks ago, Raj.
He was. Yeah.
So we want to make sure, because people are still probably downloading his interview.
Yeah.
That he's a good guy.
Great guy. Very strong early influence.
All right. So he's one of your influencers, mentors.
100%.
Okay. So you're in Paris now. What happens?
So I can't work there because I'm only on a student. I can basically go to school. So I basically got enrolled into a French language school to study French and learn that. And that allowed me about 6 months leeway to hang out in Paris. So hung out with a girlfriend, settled into France, did that whole adventure, learned French in the meantime, did a couple of odd jobs off the books here and there. And that was through the spring of that year.
Did you learn French or you got pieces of it?
I learned it. So I did 14 weeks of intensive French school there. And by living with her and working a couple different odd jobs, was able to pick up conversationally fluent French.
All right. So keep going.
So from there, visa's expiring. Knew I wanted to stay with the French girl. So we did the wise thing of going ahead to get married when I was 20.
I missed that somewhere.
Yes.
Go ahead.
It's not on my LinkedIn.
Yeah, good idea. Okay, so go ahead.
Right, so we got married again for the sake
Stories
of staying together and all that. But I did have to
It a visa marriage or was there...
There was a connection and we wanted to stay together.
Okay, go ahead.
But it was certainly for the papers. So I got hitched when I was 20 in Paris, came back to New York for about 3 months to basically sort out my affairs, get things ready. I actually worked at Dovetail that summer on the Upper West Side with John Fraser. Then at that point, I knew, hey, I'm going back to France. I have the papers of all the jobs and restaurants. Sommelier seems like the best. So that's what I want to pursue. So that summer when I was back in New York, I enrolled in the Cordon Bleu, which was meant to start in September of that year. That would have been September 2012. Finished out my summer Dovetail. Went back to Paris as planned to be with the missus and to start the Cordon Bleu. And then day one that I landed, we actually broke up.
Ah.
So that was a tricky set of circumstances.
Who broke up with who?
She broke up with me.
And what was the reason? She met someone else?
I found out after the fact that she did. But the explanation at the time was that it's not working. You went back to New York.
Okay.
X, Y, and Z. But there I am in Paris.
I don't
want
to sound like a dad, but that was probably the best thing that happened to you. All right. So go ahead. So now you're kind of free in many ways. You could work. You don't have the wife.
Yeah. Well, free, but also locked in. Now I'm signed up for the Cordon Bleu for 9 months.
Yeah.
I've been alone in Paris.
But for a second, do you say, crap, you know, I don't have the relationship anymore. What am I doing here? Or are you excited to be there and do the Cordon Bleu course?
It was both. I mean, there was definitely, it was daunting because I, you know, banked my whole future on this and told my friends there was an actual wedding and everything. But like you're saying, I was free now, just shy of my 21st birthday, 2 weeks after in Paris, ready to go to the Cordon Bleu. So there was optimism as well.
So you do the program?
I do the program. I moved to, at that time, to Malakoff, just south of Paris, which is a little commune there. Got myself a rented a room and then did the 9 months at Cordon Bleu.
And then what's the how do you pronounce? Lesser. Did you work there?
I did. So that was the second half of my time at Cordon Bleu. You get enrolled in basically as a stagiaire in a different business. And I was lucky enough to land a 3-week stage that turned into a 6-month job at Restaurant Lesser under Antoine Pitrus.
So does that indicate they kept you on a little longer because they liked you?
They liked me. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I could speak French. I was a savvy busboy and was ready to count
and
bottles. So.
Awesome wine list there, right?
Incredible.
All right. What happens after that?
So did my time at Lesser, finished out at the Cordon Bleu, 9 months of intensive wine focus, decided to go back to New York and work in distribution for a bit. My logic at the time was that most somms leave the floor to sell wine anyway, so why don't I do that now?
That's a good idea.
I figured I'd get ahead of it. Sold wine for a company called MFW, which is a fantastic biodynamic organic focused book. Did that up in Westchester, but then ultimately felt the calling to go back to restaurants. Worked in a couple different places, worked at Murray's Cheese, and then landed at Blue Hill at Stone Barns when I was 23 as a somm.
So that probably makes you the youngest. We'll talk about it, but you emerged to the beverage director.
I did. I think Hannah's got me beat by a little bit from the youngest, but.
We'll talk about Hannah later. Yeah. Probably beats you in a lot of stuff. But
that's for sure.
All right. So Blue Hill, how many years?
4.5 years.
4.5 years. I guess I'll ask you now, why do you leave Blue Hill?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. I think at the time I did 4.5 years, and part of it was the intensity and the demands of the job at large. 4.5 years, there was a big chunk of time. But also having the sense that if I stayed there 5 years, it might quickly turn into 15. And I wanted to basically give myself a chance to leave Blue Hill, explore their opportunities, broaden my horizons.
So it was a career thought move.
Correct.
Let me do it now or, okay. So what happens after that?
So I left Blue Hill, landed at the Wine Spectator Project in Hudson Yards, where I was lucky enough to work with Michael Engelman, as well as a range of really talented professionals.
Michael had left the Modern to go to...
Correct. Right. Where he wrote one of the most amazing books, I think, of all time.
And I think that's where COVID now takes a play.
That's right. So March of that year, I was able to do about 4 months at Wine Spectator. And then on March, everything shut down. And that was that. So
you're dormant during COVID.
Dormant during COVID for about 5 months. I wouldn't say totally dormant. We got a puppy and I picked up a jump rope. But
let's go backwards for a second, because I love Michael and I'm curious about you. Do you think if COVID didn't happen... Michael would have hung around Wine Spectator, or that was a passing thing, you know, very corporate, big. And what about you on that front too?
For sure. I mean, I can't speak to Michael and his decisions, but he did love it there. He put a lot of work into that opening, which was immense.
So he probably would have hung for a bit.
Yeah. I mean, think for him to leave the Modern to go to that project, he was probably pretty convinced already. So I imagine he probably would have stuck around. And I would have as well. I actually got promoted to the Bar and Spirits Director, which I held for 2 days before COVID. So I probably would have stayed with that group.
Did you have a relationship with Michael previous to that?
No. I'd served him once at Blue Hill, but otherwise, none.
All right. So COVID comes. You said 5 months later. I guess this is where Northrop pops up?
Correct. So I was getting kind of antsy. Wanted to get off the sofa and saw an opportunity for a beverage manager role with John Fraser Restaurants out in the North Fork of Long Island.
Of course, was Claudia Fleming gone by then?
She was. So they sold the restaurant in, I think it was December of 2019, which was great timing for them. And then John Fraser took it on, I think January, February of 2020.
Okay. So you just kind of missed her.
Just kind of missed her.
Because the final thing, the funny thing is you wind up at Gramercy and she goes to their new opening, you know, in 7 years, their first new opening. All right. So what was curious to me, you were not at North Fork that long. What happens there?
So it was an amazing experience. I joined there as a beverage manager, ended up taking on the role as general manager a couple months later. It was my first chance to really run a restaurant, work closely with the executive team and John Fraser, and really build my chops on the operation side. But it was definitely a taxing 9 months. This is the height of COVID. It's the height of the enforcement from all sorts of...
And none of your history places you on Long Island. So what's the geography of that?
For me, an opportunity to, you know, do something different.
What about like living? You were commuting there?
I was commuting. So it's
so that's taxing too.
2.5 hour drive. They had a room for me there. So at least 3 or 4 times a week, I was driving back and forth. So.
Okay. So you're there how long?
9 months.
All right. So let's get to how does Gramercy Tavern come up?
Popped up on my radar in terms of opportunities. I was looking to move back to the city in the spring of this year.
So you kind of found that there were things going on there?
Correct. Yeah.
Reached out?
I reached out to Chris Raftery, who was the beverage director there, is still on the team. And I've known for a bit. Incredible guy. And chatted with him. And he said, why don't you come in and meet the team and go from there?
That was it.
Did that. Met with Jenny Guzio. Met with Mike Anthony.
Is Jenny now the whole group wine person?
She is, yeah.
Because I know she was doing a couple of restaurants. I think her and Michael split it or something. Or...
Yeah, I don't know what exactly the breakdown is now, but she is the corporate beverage director USHG.
All right, so that brings us up to current. I wanted to get through it quickly, but there was enough going on. Yeah. My favorite part of the story is you got married. So let's go back to Blue Hill. You get to Blue Hill. No questions. It's a one-of-a-kind restaurant.
For sure.
I mean, there's a lot of great restaurants. I mean, Le Bernardin and Danielle are awesome, but like two French guys, you know, wizards are, you know, the chefs and all that. Blue Hill is this whole, you know, mindset and everything.
Right.
When you got there, did you realize how unique it was? And, you know... I think there were challenges because it's a pairing menu more than most traditional restaurants. And I mean, did you feel like, wait a second, do I have the chops for this place? I mean, what were you, address those questions.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I quickly realized it's a one of a kind place. Something that's been built for, I guess it's 20 years now. And between David Barber, Dan Barber, Philippe Goose, kind of the key players among many others for building out Blue Hill at Stone Barns. But quickly realized, yes, this place is different. Because I had my background at La Serre and Danielle. I knew what traditional high-level French fine dining was.
What good is. Yeah. And traditional.
Right. And this was a restaurant that checked all those boxes of fine dining, but also broke the rules in every right direction and had a different spirit than any other restaurant.
Do you think that's what made it so unique?
That spirit, for sure. That spirit of creativity, spontaneity, bigger goals, bigger missions, storytelling. Yeah.
So when you saw the wine program, I mean, you didn't shit or anything because you were at La Serre, but it's pretty impressive.
For sure. And it was daunting. And I think I went into that job underqualified. And big props to Charles Puglia and Charlie Berg, the beverage director and head sommelier at the time, for giving me the chance. But that was a 2,200 reference wine list. Whereas at La Serre, I was working in the cellar, working the list, but I was still a commis sommelier, polishing glasses, running food. So I was in over my head for sure, but they gave me a shot and... thankfully, I lasted long enough to actually learn that list properly and took it from there.
But both those guys left.
They did.
You know, as we mentioned in the intro, you became the BEV director.
Correct. It was about 2 years after starting.
Before we get off of Blue Hill, like we said, you walk into an awesome wine program and cellar. Was there anything or much that you did? I mean, did you change things? Were there weaknesses? It's hard to push a weakness on Blue Hill, but, you know, were there things that you were able to do once the floor cleared?
Yeah. So it's important, I think, for listeners to kind of understand how Blue Hill works a bit differently than other restaurants. If you haven't been before, of course, please do go. But it is, in a way, a tasting menu restaurant, but rather than having a fixed menu, there is no menu there. And again, I'm speaking to what it looks like when I'm there. It's been 2 years now. It's changed quite a bit for the better. But this is a restaurant where the captains greet the table, they take dietary restrictions and allergies, and then a blank dupe goes to the kitchen, and every single table in that restaurant gets a different experience. Both the order of the dishes themselves, where they're going for a field trip. The entire dining room is one big crazy, or 20
What's
crazy.
What's the field trip? You get up from your table and...
Correct. Go to the bakery, go to the manure shed, eventually the wine cellar. But the whole restaurant night to night is like 20 different jazz solos going on at once.
Jeez.
So being thrown into that as a sommelier and we have to pair with that is like clapping to the beat of 20 different jazz solos. So not a weakness, but certainly a challenge. I think alongside that, it's a restaurant that, of course, champions all manner of different things. But one of them is local produce, things coming from Stone Barns, from Hudson Valley and a bit beyond.
The brothers have a farm in the Berkshires, and they have... They grow stuff outside of the restaurant.
So how do you square your identity as a sommelier or beverage director when you've got 22,000 bottles of wine from all over the world? So that for me going in was like trying to find your identity as a somm on this local sustainable
So what do you
ecosystem.
Do?
I think you have the same conversations that the service team has and chef has about selecting varieties for flavor, be it vegetables or grapes. You talk about land stewardship, which I don't think there's a better example of than viticulture. You talk about organic farming, regenerative farming, and it's the same conversations. So once you realize that, and once you realize that terroir has a place with Stone Barns and with every bottle in that cellar, you don't feel like quite a black sheep anymore.
So we'll probably talk about it now and maybe when we talk about Gramercy, but these guys are like the ultimate farm to table, regenerative, you know, all of that. The wine list doesn't necessarily reflect that. And I don't say that in a negative way. You know, I think there's a lot of high net clients, collectors, you know, you got to have Bordeaux, Burgundy.
Right.
And I think this cellar serves that well, but there's also that other vibe.
For sure.
You know, that is consistent with some of the food served and the whole regenerative, sustainable thing.
Yeah.
Is that an area you moved a little more towards? Or
I think so. And again, I think the ethos of a lot of the winemakers that make up the list, it does align with the values of Stone Barns and of Blue Hill.
Right.
Of course, there's a need to champion local wineries, which Blue Hill always has and continues to do from the Finger Lakes to the North Fork. I always joke that it would be an all local wine list. Today we did a pop-up in Burgundy, but until that happens, we're going to champion great growers from all over the world.
Jump to North Fork because you're on the North Fork where the majority of Long Island wineries are.
Right.
There's a handful in the South. Was it previous to you getting there and you being there an obligation to have a decent showing of those wines?
Yeah.
Or I mean, some are great, many are okay, and there's a lot of meh there.
Yeah, I think there's an obligation for a restaurant like that, especially with what Claudia and Jerry built over the years, to be part of that community. And it is a community that's made up in part by winemakers. So the obligation did exist. And it's something that Amy Racine, who's the beverage director for John Fraser Restaurants, did a great job of championing and building out that initial list and continued to help me write it throughout my time there. So yes, an obligation, and an obligation also to pick the best ones, be it Macari or Palmin Oak and the like.
So let's
really
talk about that because
I like them.
People love to hear from the experts, of course, which you are. Give me three or four wineries worth visiting. So you said Macari.
Macari.
We know Gabrielle. She's terrific. It's a family winery. Palmanuk has been on the radar. A couple other things?
A couple others. Certainly Channing Daughters, which
That's Michael Anthony, the chef at your Gramercy Tavern's brother-in-law?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
But independent of that, happens to be one
definitely
of the most awesome
so. And they make
there.
More different wines, skews, you can
call. Break the mold and they do it properly. So Channing Daughters is a huge one. McCall Winery, which makes really beautiful Pinot Noirs and has the courage to hold them back for later releases and really, you know, show their might. And then I would say One Woman Wines is another great one.
Never heard of that.
Yeah, check
it
out.
Is that relatively new, or it's been around but hasn't gotten?
I think about 10 or 15 years old. Okay. I don't know the exact date.
One Woman Wines.
One Woman Wines. They make great Grunewaldliner.
That's a good one, William. All right. While we're on this topic, mm-hmm. before we move to talking about Gramercy and all that stuff, let me get your take on a few things. So we talked about you coming up and coming through the business. And like I said, you literally went from busboy to Burgundy expert. But along the way, were there influencers or wines? Like, are you the Burgundy guy? Like, we've had guests that only worked in Italian restaurants. Like Audrey Frick wasn't on too long ago. A lot of exposure to Italian. So that sort of what was your thing, you know, coming up? Or there wasn't one.
I mean, I've always had a particular affinity for Burgundy and Northern Rhone and Piedmont, Loire Valley, Beaujolais.
Man, you're speaking my language.
Yeah. So those are all, I mean, just delicious, vibrant wines that speak to place and have focus aromatically has always been big for me. But working in New York, for the most part, you've access to anything and everything. So there's never settling into a particular group for too long. I've grown to love Italy more and more over the years, despite the frustrations about how hard
beyond
it is to learn. And
Piedmont?
Beyond Piedmont,
I mean, do you appreciate Tuscan wines, Chianti, Classico?
Love Chianti. My Terraponi Chianti Classico is kind of, you know, our house wine.
That's the Grand Cru guys.
Yeah, which is delicious. And love that.
And it's reasonably priced, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is something we pour by the glass for $20 at Gramercy.
So Eric Asimov, who's been on, mm-hmm. has been a big... He talked about it on the show not that long ago. He did a story. He's actually going to be at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival during a seminar there.
Yeah, their wines are amazing. But outside of that, I think the one big other region would be Corsica. Corsica is a place where Charles Puglia planted his flag early on, and I've always championed as well, thanks to books like IPO and Enrico Ibanez. Corsican wine is definitely an inspiring
so
area.
So give me some makers beyond like Abatucci. Like, what should we look for in Corsica? Because I think you're right. If people listen to this show and they want to try interesting wines, Corsican wines certainly
Corsica.
Should be on their radar.
For sure.
Give me some producers worth looking up.
So you named Abatucci, which is the big one. I would say Yves Canarelli, another fantastic name.
Spell Canarelli, C-A-N-E.
C-A-N-A-R-E-L-L-I. Okay. Yves Canarelli, who's phenomenal. And then Antoine Arena, another great producer to look
for. A-R-E-N-A, all right. Okay. So Arena, Canarelli, and of course Abatucci. And just give me a brief, you know, when you move towards Corsican wines, what are you experiencing?
So the white wines, I think, are the most interesting and the most, you know, delicious of them all. And what's great about Corsican white wines is there's something texturally I always find with them. And there's this kind of this ripeness and density alongside minerality. But the wines aren't crazy aromatic. They're relatively neutral wines. Vermentino is a very dominant grape, and Barbarossa and these fun Corsican grapes. But they're wines that have a concentration and texture that's kind of unlike any other.
So aromatically, you said they're
neutral.
Not. But on the palate, there's a lot of
texture and density. And what's great about wines like that is they can kind of be magnifying glasses for flavors. So from a pairing perspective, Corsican white wines are fantastic.
Those are good recos. What about, has there been an ongoing legitimate interest even before Blue Hill in natural and sustainable wines? Was that something, and be honest here, that was happening but not on your radar, always peripherally? I mean, it's hard not to talk about those wines.
Yeah, for sure.
I had a woman on last week, Cerise Zelenich. She mm-hmm. just opened a natural wine bar in Bushwick around the corner.
Yeah, for sure.
Natural wine.
Natural.
That's it.
Right.
You know. And she kind of went, you know, with producers that are not even at other.
Right.
So talk to me about, you know, how you look at that. And you're in the type of restaurants where it's not the easiest place.
For sure. So natural wine, it coming through Danielle and La Serre and Le Cordon Bleu, it's not a huge area of focus, very
right.
traditional kind of, you know, to the point wine programs by and large. But natural wine, of course, has increased immensely in the past decade or so, both for its, you know, the attention it gains and the amount of fans that it has. I'm one of those annoying people that say, you know, I like good natural wine. in a way, because there's a lot of amazing natural wines out there, but I think there's been kind of a problem with both the consumer and also the salespeople around natural wine that's done a lot of damage. And I thought about this most at Blue Hill, because like we talked about, there's a big value on land stewardship and proper farming and regenerative agriculture. And there's this weird habit with natural wine these days to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, hey, because you added, you know, some sulfites of bottling, all your farming and hard work and your 10 generations don't matter anymore. So that's a frustrating thing for me that I experience in natural wine.
There's some inconsistencies.
Inconsistencies. And I think natural wine doesn't get the same scrutiny that other wines do, meaning that for all the people that I've ever had in a restaurant that are seeking out natural wine, I've never had them send back a bottle. Whereas there's been plenty of times when somebody ordered a natural wine inadvertently and they sent it back because they don't like it.
Right. So that's an interesting take. I'll come back to the question when we talk about, you know, about Gramercy, because that's an interesting place too. So you gave me some good, you know, wine recos and tips and all that. But after spending all the years at Blue Hill, North Fork, currently at Gramercy, tell me about, and we talked about a few, but give me some more either off the radar or things you've discovered, like maybe things that you've tried that maybe won't fit at a Gramercy, or something that you've tried that you've brought in.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would say we've got great, delicious natural wine at Gramercy, and something we're going to continue to include, but I've rediscovered Beaujolais lately.
Okay.
For sure. And
I'm surprised as a Burgundy guy, you're not on the bandwagon.
Yeah, I mean, I've loved Burgundy, but there's also a certain amount of frustration that comes with Burgundy over time, of course, the prices, but also, you know, how many times you want to compare 20 different red Burgundies that are all Pinot Noir and might not necessarily have enough fruit.
So Beaujolais, favor any one of the crus more than the other?
Love Morgon. That's probably a good one.
Next, Fleury.
Fleury's great.
What are you going to say? Give me a couple of producers that you...
So I would say, as of late, the one I'm super stoked about is Daniel Bouland.
Spell?
Bouland is Bouland.
Okay.
And I don't want the cat to get out of the bag here, but Daniel Bouland, for me, is making wines up there with Fourillard in terms of deliciousness and complexity and food friendliness. And
is he doing Morgon and Fleury? And
Morgon, there's a bit of Cote de Brie. Yeah, amazing second generation sustainable estate.
That's currently have it at Gramercy?
We probably have 25 different references of it. Like, he probably owns 60% of our total Beaujolais selection. I'm in love with these wines.
And what you love and believe translates to putting it in front of the food and the customer reaction.
Right, because it's accessible.
You're not pushing something too hard you like. You got the right thing out there.
No, it still comes with the guest first. I'm not going to ever buy wines that
I just, you know, if you have to pivot, you pivot.
It's a way I love them too.
Did you travel much? You know, when you did you ever do wine regions? Like once you started working, you couldn't do harvest as much. But did you do wine trips, or you were too busy?
Mostly too busy. And you have to turn down most of them. When I was in France, of course, got to cover most corners of France itself. But had a chance to go to Austria when I was with MFW and explore the Wachau and the vineyards around Vienna.
Terrific wines, Austria.
Amazing.
Right?
Yeah. So that was a big opportunity. Had a chance to go to Corsica this year, actually.
Oh, so you had a recent trip. Good for you.
Correct, which is awesome.
Because COVID shut everything
down.
So after it seemed right, you got out to Corsica. Right.
So Austria, Corsica, the North Fork of Long Island.
Where would you love to go? Is it that traditional Burgundy trip and reach those guys, or is there anywhere else?
I've done Burgundy quite a bit now. I had a chance to go to La Fleuve and to DRC, which was
you've been
amazing.
There, done that.
I'd love to. I've never really done Italy properly, and never gone to Piedmont or Sicily or
Polio. There's plenty of places for you to go
for sure.
All right, William. We have to take a quick break. We are talking to William Carroll. William is the beverage director at Gramercy Park Tavern. When we get back, we'll talk a little about Gramercy, which is certainly one of the restaurants and wine programs worth spending time talking about. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
The This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca, helping you to plan your next getaway. Ithaca has waterfalls and wineries, art and theater, outdoor recreation, and family fun. The area is famous for its glacier-carved gorges, co-op-run businesses, and cultural influences from Cornell University and Ithaca College. Plus, you can't beat the beauty of Cayuga Lake, the largest of the Finger Lakes. Beyond 150 waterfalls and some of the region's best hiking trails, Ithaca is cider. The area is well known for its local cideries, which are leading the way in America's cider revival. You can hear from the region's cider makers directly on HRN series Hardcore. There's something really special about Ithaca's climate for cultivating delicious apples steeped in history and terroir. Let Visit Ithaca help you plan your next trip to this hub of food, drink, culture, and agritourism. Home of New York's craft cider, I love New York. Get started at visitithaca.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, young William Carroll. William is the beverage director and assistant GM, whatever that means. He gets a key to the back door at Gramercy Tavern. All right, let's talk about your gig at Gramercy Tavern. Yep. We're not talking, just like Blue Hill is so unique, you know, Gramercy Tavern is certainly iconic. I mean, it is one, the quintessential American restaurant. It is one of Danny Meyer's oldest restaurants. Right. And when you say that, you're talking over 27 years. And in the restaurant biz, and certainly in New York, I mean, that's awesome. That's older than you, I think. So that's been quite a run. So the first thing I want to ask is sort of general. You know, Danny Meyer has sort of created this vibe about how to run a restaurant. He was the first to do the non-tipping. He wrote a book right. about hospitality. I mean, what is it like to work in a Danny Meyer restaurant? Is that imprint, you know, there when you walk in, or is it BS?
It's there. I mean, it was there for me.
What is it? I mean, you know, what is working at a Danny Meyer? I mean, what are those things?
It's something, I mean, it's a few different things. I don't want to speak too much for Danny or the company, but...
Yeah, no, I want it through your lens.
Yeah, for sure. And my lens is a good one because, again, coming off a more traditional, old-school French restaurant
and interesting, you know, selection of restaurants.
Too. Yeah, for sure. But there's something I got from day one of trailing of the entire staff having a great deal of respect for one another from management down, of the entire staff being proud to work in restaurants and treat their job like a career. That's something you feel from the get-go and has not let up since I've joined.
It's you have to keep, I think I got from Danny's book that the old way to look at it was do whatever for the customer. I think Danny realized if you have happy employees, for they sure. go out and you have happy customers.
Yeah, and that's
is definitely that the case. Still going on now?
For sure. Staff comes first, especially through this pandemic. Not only, I mean, it's in setting the table and it's been built in all those restaurants of treating staff as your number one priority. Because it makes good business sense and it creates great hospitality.
Right.
That's something that's been, I think, magnified through the pandemic and all the trials felt by restaurant workers. And it's something that, you know, is very live and well today.
Is it so much different than other restaurants? I mean, is that vibe and that focus prominent?
Yeah,
I mean, I think Blue Hill, they're pretty good about everything.
Sure.
But Danny has this, you know, ideal. Is it, it's part of the mantra?
Yeah. And it's much more codified from, it's a pretty big restaurant group. And this is top down. You feel it from everybody, from the executive team down to, you know, the busboys and future sommeliers. That feeling of being valued, of being respected, of taking your work very seriously, of being a 51%er, of striving for excellence, that is perforates the whole company.
That's great to hear because I think the pandemic shine a light on a lot 100%. Of stuff that's not right with the business. Maybe we'll get to that later. So you have a chef there, Mike Anthony, who's, you know, legendary. He hasn't been there from the beginning. I think it was Tom Colicchio or something. But Mike's been there a long time. And you have a pairing menu and you have the tavern, Gramercy right. Tavern, which is more a la carte. Let's talk about the beverage program. Again, lucky young Will walks into like this awesome, you know, cellar.
Yeah.
Tell me what you walk into.
So I walk into an amazing wine cellar. You know, that has probably, I think at this point, it's 900 references, which is about the same as when I started. Spans the globe, very diverse. Champions small growers, champions accessible price points alongside blue chip Burgundies and the like.
The champion small grower, does that go back years or was that a fairly recent development?
This goes back years and years. And
okay.
I'm not totally privy to the full history of it. But
right, but there's something going on there.
For sure. From Paul Greco through, of course, Juliet Pope, who's
essential
for the industry of making wine more accessible and
right.
activating the staff. Small growers, accessible price points, just non-pretentious, delicious wines, always been part of the DNA there.
Is there a skew because it's like Gramercy Tavern and an American Tavern? Is there a heavier hit towards American wines? Is it the classic Bordeaux? How does the list shake out?
It still leans probably 65-70% old world, focused on France and Italy. So nothing too groundbreaking there.
Within France and Italy, is that mostly Bordeaux and Tuscans and then a little Piedmont, or
there's
is
probably Burgundy's probably the biggest shake of things.
Burgundy, I meant.
And then Loire Valley, Rhone Valley, Bordeaux's definitely there. It's something I've actually tried to slim down a bit as of late. But across, again, France, Italy, wherever, there are, yes, blue chip regions, but also heavy representation of tavern friendly, delicious wines.
Right. So you get there, and like we said, they're there like 27 years. Uh-huh. And that's about how old you are, and you come in. Is there an opportunity for you to put your touches on it? Are there things blatantly obvious to you that, you know, this has been sitting here or the market sort of yearns for this? I mean, what do you have to do? What are you able to do? What do you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, there was carte blanche, of course, you know, keeping the likes of Jenny and Mike Anthony in the loop from the start, but freedom to put a creative touch on things and revamp things. So in terms of what I walked into, the cellar itself, again, is fantastic. And there's been a lot of great buying through Juliet Pope, through Chris Raftery. But we also walked into a cellar that had been kind of dormant for basically a year and a half. So the first look was to say, hey, where are these wines at? Maybe some of these younger, fresher, brighter things we bought on release and expected to sell quickly are still here. So you kind of go through them, make sure that they're still sound and delicious, and make it a point to use those first before I go ahead and start buying a bunch of wine.
Right. It's a good point.
Yeah.
What made sense then is now almost 2 years old.
Right. It's not fresh, delicious, vibrant aromatics.
They're not, like the vintage cellar wines.
Yeah.
They're, you know, the wines that should be served on a regular.
And there were wines that, you know, weren't quite tasting great anymore. And we just took the loss and decided not to serve them.
Was there any area that like, Jesus, this place has no Northern Rhone wines or Southern? I mean, was there an area that for whatever reason, I wouldn't say neglected, but wasn't where it should be that you were able to?
Yeah, for me, the rooms for growth, and this isn't necessarily because it was a deficit before, but maybe they sold a lot or
right.
whatever I walked into. So it's not an oversight by the restaurant, but Champagne, Beaujolais, Chianti all needed some love. So they got it first.
You know, Champagne is like the hottest thing. And Union Square Hospitality, like Martin Maiolino, I mean, these were like Champagne guys, right? But Gramercy Tavern needed to rethink, but to make sure the Champagne play.
Flesh it out a bit. I do think Champagne, if anything's gotten too much attention in the past 5 years or so.
Yeah. Well, it deserves it.
It deserves it.
But now it's where it should be at the table, and let's move on.
Right.
Right.
But it did need some love, so Champagne we look towards, and again, tavern-friendly, delicious things. Beaujolais, Chianti.
Is it fair to say Gramercy Tavern, even more than most restaurants, is all about a very curated beer list and cider list and even some cool teas and all of that? I mean, is there as much there or more than, you know, most places, do you feel? Or that's what you see at, you know, better restaurants?
I think curated in the sense that the strategy is not just to buy everything, which is an easy approach you can make if you've got a budget for it. I'll build a great wine list because I have $2 million and I'll just buy everything. It's curated in that sense of being selective, of buying wines that make sense for the guest, not necessarily the sommelier that's serving them. So in that sense, yes. And be it draft beer or cider very early on that front, Riesling, things like that.
But even to the point where, you know, restaurants don't feel they have to carry cider or they have two beers or whatever. Is it important to have that curation, right?
Yeah, I think the curation is important, but I'm also all for having, like right now we have four beers on draft. There's nine draft lines, but for me, four is the right number.
Okay.
Like more is not better. So let's have four that are local and fresh and in sixthels and we can rotate them versus saying, hey, here's
makes sense.
Nine different oddball.
What's the most recent draft beer you just tapped?
Most recent draft beer we just tapped would be, it's from North Fork Brewing Company.
Okay.
On Long Island. And
it's okay.
I may have bought it because of the name. It is called Hold Me Closer Tiny Lager.
Okay, that's a good
and
one.
And it is just a delicious, crushable,
but it is good.
German Pilsner.
That's a good one. By the glass.
Yes.
Is that important? And
for
is
sure.
that fun for you? I mean, are there wines that are by the glass that are not necessarily regular bottle-less wines or both?
Yeah, so I would say it's kind of twofold. The standard by the glass selection or what we have on the list does lean on classic regions. So we have a Sancerre, we have a Beaujolais, we have a Syrah, we have a Chianti. Just great, again, approachable, recognizable wines. And the best version of each category. I think that's important for by the glass of finding the best Sancerre. Finding
is that
the best.
Stuff that you can buy beyond what's in the cellar, or it's usually?
So that stuff is what we can buy what's beyond the cellar because it's a very busy restaurant. We need a certain amount of volume to keep these on by the glass. But in terms of things that are more curated and exciting and special, we started a program called Check the Chalkboard. And every Sunday at Gramercy, there's a little chalkboard behind the bar. And it's got the GT logo. And beneath that, we'll write in very simple chalk, glass of Burgundy, $28. And we'll probably open up an old bottle of Fourier and just pour it by the glass for that day.
So you won't necessarily say Fourier.
We won't say Fourier.
And that's sort of dealer's choice. You decide what
correct.
You want to put out.
And it's a nod to
and
like,
it's usually cool and a good value.
Cool and an incredible value.
So $29 for a Fourier, to some people, that's a lot of, that's what they pay for two bottles of wine.
Right.
But that's pretty reasonable, right?
We're losing money on a lot of these pours.
Right.
And
so
it's a great way to champion amazing
that's just on Sundays?
Just on Sundays.
All right,
and
so
until the bottles pour out.
On Sundays
that's
to
right.
Gramercy. You'll get a good deal there.
And it's a nod to like a brasserie in France. If you go to get a steak tartare, you'll see a chalkboard that just says AOP Côte de Bordeaux. There's no producer. There's no vintage. There's nothing. But you know that it's going to be a great glass of wine.
Very cool. All right, so do you spend time with Michael as far as, you know, the menu and the food, the seasonal changes? I mean, that has to influence current and future buying, right?
For sure. Yeah.
Tell me about, is there a collaboration or a regular discussion?
Yeah, with him and the rest of the team, it's Mike, it's John, our chef de cuisine, it's Aretta, our executive sous, and there's back and forth, very accessible both ways, front of house to back of house. So there's constant talk, there's constant communication. Mike Anthony's there at least 5 days a week,
wow.
Sometimes five and a half, six, seven. Super interested in wine, super interested in service, and he's very involved on all fronts. So he's been great to work with and is able to lend me a lot of wisdom from his 16 years there as to how to direct the program.
Does somebody order like an 89 Cheval Blanc, leave a third of the bottle, and you pour a glass for Mike and bring it back? You ever do stuff like that?
We definitely pour him a glass. He loves wine.
Okay.
Of course, he's got the Channing Daughters connection, and
right.
He spent his own time in France, so he appreciates great sips here and there.
Right. All right, so that's Gramercy Tavern. Incredible menu, incredible wine list.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly about the menu. The back of the house, not back of the house kitchen, but the back dining,
the
room,
dining room
is a pairing menu, right?
Correct.
Three, four, five courses?
Yeah, so it's effectively, in a way, it's two restaurants in one. You have the tavern up front, a la carte menu, and the dining room in the back, which is great because you've got to walk through the party to get to the church, which is what
right.
we like at Gramercy.
I like that.
That's not my line, that's Danny's. But we've got the great balance of fine dining and a tasting menu and curated pairings and synchronized drops and clears, and then the tavern. So it's really this nice yin and yang.
The pairing thing.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of people say, William, you know, we're doing this menu. We'd like to drink two, three, four wines. I think glasses would be the best thing. We're leaving it to you versus, you know, I really want to figure out a Burgundy and a Bordeaux or a white.
Yeah.
And a what what percentage of people do bottles versus nothing scientific,
right?
Where do people, like, I would love to delve into bottles, but I'd rather leave it to you and get that third or fourth taste.
For sure.
So where are people going with that?
I would say of the folks that are drinking, because a lot of folks go the non-alcoholic route, which is great. Of the folks that are drinking, probably 60 to 65 do a pairing.
Okay. So it's a higher percentage.
Strong number, yeah.
Of more tastes, leaving it to you.
Correct.
Or what you've designed.
We have a great pairing for, it was $85, now it's $98, so it's a very accessible price point for pairings.
Very cool. All right, so that's Gramercy Tavern. That's William Carroll. When you're there, you know, he'll help you with everything. William, nobody leaves the Heritage Radio Studios in the back of Roberta's without answering our wine list. Five questions, same five questions we've asked for almost 5 years. First question is, what are you drinking now? And I don't mean the Chinon. I mean, what's in the fridge? What are you and Hannah trying and curious about? What's at the restaurant that maybe is not on the list, but, you know, you have a persistent sales guy and it's interesting you?
Yeah.
Give me some stuff.
The Daniel Boulan Beaujolais I already mentioned.
Okay, that's a great one. What'd you say? Boulan?
Correct.
Okay.
And those wines I cannot get enough of. Pepier Muscadet, always and forever.
My favorite.
Those are probably the two big ones for go-to.
Okay.
Drinkers.
Now, Pepier Muscadet, there's the Pepier Muscadet, the regular, mm-hmm. I mean, are like the, do they make a Clisson or something?
Yeah, they've got the different Climats as well.
Are those worth it too, or you're good with the...
They're definitely worth it. What's great about the straight Muscadet Severmont is it retails at like $14-$15. But I had a chance to go to Pepier. I tasted wines back to the 80s at the estate, and they rival Montrachet for complexity. So do seek out the
I love hearing that.
And age them too.
I'm a big Muscadet fan. All right. So that's Beaujolais and Muscadet. That's a great answer. All right. Do you have, either working in the biz, home, holidays, do you have a favorite wine and food pairing?
Wine and food pairing. I've always been a champion of Egon Mueller Cabernet Riesling and Cool Ranch Doritos.
That's a good one.
It's delicious.
So wait, the Cabernet Riesling.
Cabernet Riesling,
is
Schwarzkopf Burger, and Cool Ranch Doritos.
Drier, medium?
It's drier, but there's some sweetness and just guitar chord acidity to it.
So what's the match? That all that powdery coating, all those flavors.
There's the tropical notes you get with Cabernet Riesling out of the Mosel. There's always this like kind of kiwi flavor. And that playing off the salty, acidic, Cool Ranch Doritos is a good time.
That's a good one. I'm going to have to try that.
Good to go.
But I could use any Cabernet Riesling.
Any Cabernet Riesling.
I mean, that's a good one, bud.
Yeah.
All right. Between COVID and being sort of out of the loop, taking on a new job, you know, you don't get out that much. But if you had to look at wine restaurants and or bars that you hang out or you admire because they have the vibe, they have the list, they have the knowledge.
Yeah.
Anything come to mind?
For me, Eli's Table is a great bet.
Is that the Upper East Side?
It's Upper East, correct.
Okay.
Just for a great classic French fare and a really killer wine list with good value.
So the food is really good.
It's great. There's nothing insanely ambitious about it, but it's quality ingredients, well executed, and it's alongside a
And I know he's worked hard and tried hard to have great wines there, and he succeeded.
That they do.
Now, out of curiosity, do you live up around that area or no?
So we live up in Dobbs Ferry in Westchester.
Okay. So because it's an easy answer if you live within five, six blocks.
That will make the trip.
All right, so that's a good one. Give me one or two other ones that come to mind.
Oh, to drink good wine. I don't get out of
anything
much
up in West. That's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Anything up in Westchester that, you know, do you guys ever go out and like, let's casual?
There is. I think we always bring our own wine up in Westchester. It's a bit of a desert for quality wine. And somebody's got to jump on that.
Same thing with northern New Jersey. Not the worst thing.
But of course, you've got Crabtree Kittle House. Still has quite the cellar. You've got River Market in Tarrytown. That's great.
Good.
Yeah. That's also Glenn, who built the program at Kittle House.
So a lot.
Lanizio's in Scarsdale. If anybody wants killer Italian food in Westchester, go to Lanizio.
So a lot of people give Manhattan and Brooklyn answers. You're so busy and you're going south to north and back that you're not really hanging out.
We stay home, we cook, hang out with the dog.
All right, that's good. All right, fourth question is favorite all-time wine. I am the most repetitious guy you'll ever meet, but I always say the question was originally structured, and you've been around, you know, William, what was that rare expensive wine that, you know, you tasted? I don't care about that. What's the wine that was either the significant wine in your life, career, the gateway wine, the most admirable wine, the most important wine? You know, is there one or two, or is that too hard to answer?
It's multifaceted as you presented it. And I think that gateway wine is, of course, 71 Rio Sec that opened
up. Okay. And I knew that would come back. And that is certainly, that's the answer. But give me another one.
The other one, in terms of bring me to tears, incredible, would be a toss up between 88 Gentiles d'Hervieux Cote Roti and Jackie Truchot Charme Chambertin 88. But
was 88 a great year for those wines?
It's great.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. And that Truchot was the first time I've ever, the evidence of terroir was really proved to me with 88 Truchot Charme. But favorite wine is probably Domaine Dujac Maurice Saint-Denis Blanc, just a village level white wine from Maurice Saint-Denis from Dujac. That's Hannah and I's favorite wine to drink together.
So I like that.
Our favorite.
I'm just curious, you may or may not know, but retail, what does that wine go for? Is that like in the low hundreds, or is it beyond that?
Depends on the retailer if they're going to guard it and protect it. But I would say Maurice Saint-Denis Blanc from Dujac is probably $80.
Oh, okay. 85. So it could be under 100.
Right.
So that's an awesome wine for that price range.
Right.
The maker is incredible. You're getting a region of Burgundy that's not the most expensive.
Yeah. And it's a good example of reductive Burgundy done right versus reductive for the sake of reductive, which is
tell everyone quickly what reductive means.
So reductive winemaking is, in a way, it's the opposite of oxidative winemaking. So it's just a manner in which the producer protects.
Don't some people confuse reductive and oxidative?
Yeah, it's they're easily confused, but reductive, in a very simple explanation. Again, I'm not a scientist or a winemaker, but you protect the grapes and the wine itself from too much oxygen exposure, which in some producers' minds creates a lot of longevity and stability in the wine, and also makes a whole host of very kind of fennel-like, licorice-y, really seductive mineral notes. When done right, they're awesome. When they're done wrong, it tastes like, you know, garden hose.
Those are good ones. I don't know if I mentioned, but we post all your answers online.
Oh, boy.
Because not oh, boy. People look to guys like you for the best recommendations. And so far, I think you're doing an incredible job. So relax, will you? All right. Last question. Best wine around 15, 20, 22 bucks. I need a red and a white. I always say you can give me a maker or a region. I always say Muscadet. And you validated that as probably one of the greatest values as a region. And then you said Pepier, who's probably the king. So we're going to put that one anyway. But give me another white and give me a red.
I would say head to northeastern Italy, head to Colio. Borgo di Tilio makes great entry-level
Friulano blends. That's the maker?
Borgo di Tilio is the producer.
B-O-R-G-O?
Correct.
D-I?
D-I-L, I think. And then Tilio is T-I-G-L-I-O.
So it's Dill, D-I-L?
D or Dell, one or the other.
Okay, I'll look it up. Give me the last part.
So Borgo di Tilio, great entry-level Friulano.
But wait, T-I-L?
Oh, T-I-G-L-I-O. Tilio.
Tiglio. Tiglio. Okay. So that's your white. That's going to clock in under 22, 20, you know, around there.
Yeah. For the entry level, you get around 20 to 25 bucks.
Okay. Almost. That's a great reco. Yeah. How about a red?
Red for me, the one in front of us, got to say. The Picasse Chinon from Chateau de Coulaine.
So, and that could be our segue. Le Picasse, L-E-S-P-I-C-A-S-S-E-S,
yes.
Chinon. Le Picasse is the maker.
Chateau de Coulaine is the producer.
Chateau de Coulaine is the producer.
Is the Loudéan soil type.
Right. And it is a cap rank from Chinon.
Correct.
And this retail clocks in at about what?
$22, 2022.
All right. All right. Now let's get into this for a couple of minutes. Let's evaluate it. So every week we do a feature called the Weekly Wine Sip, where I strong arm my guests to bring in a bottle of wine to taste. William fought me tooth and nail, but I said, William, I'm going to cancel the show if you won't bring a wine in. Quite the opposite. William's glad to do that. And William brought in a cool wine, which, you know, I'm glad he did and suspected he would. Let's go over it again, William. Yep. It is the... Who was the maker again?
Chateau de Coulaine.
Spell Coulaine.
C-O-U-L-A-I-N-E.
Okay. Chateau de Coulaine, Le Picasse.
Correct.
And Chinon is, what is Chinon, the region?
Chinon is the region and a village in Central Loire Valley.
And it is famous for Cabernet Franc.
Correct.
So let's talk about this. You'll get into it, but is this 100% Cabernet Franc?
100% Cabernet Franc.
All right, so tell me a little about the maker. Let's talk a little about the grape, Chinon, all that.
Yeah, so this is run by the Bonaventure family. They've had this estate since the 1300s in the heart of Chinon. There's a proper castle on site. It is old school Central France winemaking. It's since been taken over. Etienne was the father that ran it up until about 3 or 4 years ago. It's since taken over by his son and daughter. And it is old school, delicious, tavern-friendly Cab Franc.
So when you say old school, delicious, tavern-friendly, this is a traditional made wine.
Traditional. It's fermented in a mixture of large wooden vats, sometimes concrete. All the farming is organic. There's no additions except for sulfites and bottling. And it sings to testable, in a way, pure, aromatically precise Cab Franc flavors.
All right, so let's get into it. I want to talk about, so color, it's pretty deep, dark purple, right? You know, it's not very translucent. It's a little brooding. I mean, it's nice. The edges are pretty solid. This is where I defer to you 100%. What do we get on the nose?
Yeah, so on the nose, you get the kind of dark fruited components you expect with Cab Franc. So there's a crushed blackberry, definitely a cassis, maybe blackberry kind of hand pie vibe to it, or pop
tart. So the hardcore black fruits,
yeah,
like cassis is in there.
No and cherry, no strawberry. It's straight
right
black fruits.
Not even dark cherries. Is that typical of most Cab Francs, or this you know traditionally made one? Or
it's typical of most the Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, or Cabernet Franc. You're going to find these flavors. There's a lot of ways for the winemaker to get in the way of that for winemaking,
right?
But this producer lets those flavors shine.
All right, I get all of that. I mean, it's a beautiful nose. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had it open. You opened it. It's been open in the glass.
It's
opened up. Now, mouthfeel, let's throw it over the tongue and let it drop down into the stomach. To me, it's a medium. It's not this unctuous mouth coating, but it's not thin.
Right.
You agree?
Yeah, you can tell you're not drinking water. It's got a little bit of weight on the palate. Right. Medium weights, medium to lights.
Yeah, medium to light.
Right.
And sometimes medium to light, oh, that sounds bad. It sounds like, no, this is, it works well for this wine.
Crushable, patio pounder, delicious Cab Franc.
Before we get to the palate, when you say patio pounder, is the alcohol reasonable on this?
We're at 13% for this.
Okay, so that's
very reasonable.
That's poundable, crushable.
Yeah, with this kind of acidity, for sure. This is great. I mean, we can get the food pairings later, but this is barbecue friendly.
So let's go on the palate. Does the palate replicate the nose, or is there anything new or different there?
You get some of the more aromatics coming through on the palate in terms of these kind of floral, violet, potpourri elements. You get the traditional,
I got violet right away.
For sure. You get the traditional bell pepper vibe, kind of jalapeno
is that
popper.
Bell pepper is common in Chinon and Cab Franc, right?
Yeah, the Cabernet family.
That vegetal, but in a good way.
Which make for vegetal aromatics.
And the black fruits, right?
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So the palate's pretty similar to the nose, you know, with some more nuances. All right, let's talk about perfect foods to pair with this.
So for me, this would be great with, if you want to touch on something richer that also has vegetal notes, so like a beef fajitas type thing. Or enchiladas would be awesome. It's an incredible sloppy joe or a burger wine. Stuffed peppers.
Wait, sloppy joe and burger.
Yeah.
Is
ideally
this,
at the same time.
Is let's go burger for a second. Is this as good a wine as any for a burger? Or there's other things way above it on the list?
This is as good as most, I would say. To be a great burger wine, you want it to be delicious and aromatically interesting in its own right, but you also want to be able to slug it back with a big rich burger and not
boxes,
worry about it.
Right?
For sure. It's got acid, it's got, you know, interesting aromatics, but it's also a great background. Let me eat a burger and drink a glass of white wine.
Is this on the list at Gramercy?
It is.
Do we like this wine or we love this wine?
I'm thinking you love this wine. We know I love this wine.
I think I like it too. No, I love it. I love it because I love that it's on the list. I love that you brought it in, and I love the pricing.
Yeah. And also might add that I got to spend a couple weeks at this domain when I was in France. And
right, you mentioned that.
Part of why I wanted to bring it today.
So this is the 2017. I thought it was even a more current vintage. The 2017 Le Picasse made by Chateau de Coulaine. In Chinon in the Loire, and it's 100% Cabernet Franc. And William, if not going to hold you to it, if we had to guess average retailish,
this, I mean, could be $20 up to $30, $35.
Okay,
for more current release.
Great value, right?
Great value
for the wine.
A great Thanksgiving wine, might I add.
Why? Up on it. Good with turkey.
Good with turkey. Again, fresh, juicy.
What's the biggest mistake people make with pairing wines? They don't pair it to the sauce, right?
They don't pair it to the sauce. And after Thanksgiving, you got to play off the gravy. And I've written a piece on pairing with Thanksgiving before. And this is a great Thanksgiving Cab Franc.
All right. So that's a great reco for that, too. All right, William, we've blown past an hour. We got to wrap it up. Let me do a quick promo, and I want to get some info from you, and then we're out of here. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. I'm on this big subscribe thing now. Just hit the subscribe button, all right? So this way, when William's interview is posted as a subscriber, it shows up. How hard is that? All right, so become a subscriber. I don't know why everyone who listens is not a subscriber. That may be a little pretentious from me, but I think you should do that. All right, follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at S. Ben Ruby. On Twitter, we're at Ben Ruby. Similar but confusing, but you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation to get you anywhere. I will post William's wine list and his weekly wine sip selection on social media. You'll start seeing stuff today or tomorrow through next week. We'll post our wine list on Insta Story and on Instagram. And William had some great recos, so I'll make sure I cover all of them. William, I forgot to ask you this. Are you even on Instagram?
I'm not on Instagram, no.
Jesus Christ.
Late to the
You're
party.
Like a Luddite. Why?
You know, I didn't get into it when I was younger, and at this point for me, the ship sailed.
So you got very old and decided
That's
it's too
right.
late
I'm,
now. Okay.
I'm not touching it.
All right. Now, Gramercy Tavern, you could always go to website, Gramercy Tavern,
right.
Google it. It's probably GramercyTavern.com or something. Gramercy Tavern.
GramercyTavern.com.
And on social media, the same thing, right?
Correct. And that's where you're going to get our Check the Chalkboard every Sunday.
Right.
A preview. Check out the story on the Instagram.
Right. And it's funny because on Twitter and Instagram, everybody has crazy handles. But Gramercy's been around so long that they were smart enough, like in the mid-late 2000s.
Yeah.
You know, we have to register that. All right. I want to thank our guest, William Carroll. William is the beverage director and assistant general manager at Danny Meyer's Gramercy Tavern. Go in there, say hello, tell him you heard him on The Grape Nation, ask him to order some good wine from you for you. Taste Michael Anthony's delicious food. I want to thank our engineer, Armin, as always, for helping us in the studio today, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.